Test, hello. I was kind of relaxing in the back, and James says, you know, it's 30 seconds after the start of class. I had no idea. Good morning. Glad to see some folks back in town. Of course, Mark is out of town with the Hines family. They're in Florida. So today we're going to be continuing Mark's prepared study, and we're going through the life of Christ based on the lessons in his book, Amazed by Jesus, Volume 2. So you're aware we've been going through the last week in the life of Christ, that is up to his crucifixion, for a while now. And we're going to be covering today the arrest. As we do, I want y'all to do me a favor and think about the mental picture you have in your head as we read these verses. If you're like me, and when you read a book, especially if you read a book more than once, you develop a mental picture of the people and the actions and the activities in the story. That is, until you see the movie, and then, you know, your mental picture is very different from what someone else's mental picture is, and so it looks different. But in the story of Jesus, we've all read this account I don't know how many times. I've been attending Parkway since I was, you know, a baby, and going through the children's Bible classes and the young adult Bible classes and adult Bible classes, and you read these stories and you think in your head of what the scene looked like and what was happening. And, you know, as we read it more and more, sometimes we pick up things that we didn't notice before, and we start to question our own mental picture. And the Bible has got so much material compressed in just a few verses. There's things sometimes that are aspects that we don't consider that, you know, were there at the time. And I think the more we think about these things, the more real it becomes to us, because it's not just a story. This is a historical event. So I want us to have that perspective as we go through this today. Just to bring you back up to speed on where we are in the week. Even before I do that, I have so many thoughts put down on paper, and they don't always match Mark's slides, and so I get a little distracted. But what did Judas agree to do for 30 pieces of silver? Betray him. That's the answer, and that's what happened here. But what was he doing for the 30? What activities were in that agreement? And this is just a discussion question, because I don't know that there's a right answer, but I'm just curious to get us thinking and talking about what did he do? Ricardo, did you say?
He told me to show it to Jesus.
Okay, yeah, he's going to show the Jewish leaders who Jesus was. Is it possible that in a crowd of people, the Jewish leaders didn't know Jesus from one of the apostles? I think they probably knew who he was, so maybe there's more even than that. James? Okay, something about seclusion. Were the Jewish leaders aware of the crowds? Okay, yeah. So going back to, let's see. In Matthew 26, we're going to be there in just a moment anyway, but Matthew 26, we read in verse 3 through 5 that the Jewish leaders, they wanted to arrest Jesus, and yet they were not wanting to do it during the festival. Why? Because of the crowds. So the goal of the Jewish leaders is to arrest and, according to these verses, to kill Jesus. But they didn't think this moment during the festival was the right time because of the crowds. And Tia?
They also would not have known about the deep area either.
Again, going back, yeah. Okay, so in Matthew 26, 14 through 16, when Judas then decides and he goes to the Jewish leaders, it seems like that's when their plans change. And it even says Judas began at that moment to look for an opportunity. So it could just be simply that they needed the right setting to get to Jesus when there wasn't a crowd around. Is that possibly it? It's interesting, we don't have in the biblical account that they needed Judas to testify against Jesus. Would that have been helpful to the Jewish leaders? If they could get Judas to testify in one of these trials that he had done something worthy of death? That would have been helpful. They didn't ask for that. They didn't ask him to lead Jesus into some kind of trap. It seems that it may have just been that simple. It may have just been, as a few people have mentioned, just needed the right moment. And Judas, perhaps because he was an insider, had knowledge of when that moment of seclusion would be. So we'll notice that as well as we go through this. Okay. Yes?
The Jews also had to coordinate with the Romans, so they had to know the time and place that the Romans told them.
Yeah, the Jews didn't have the authority to make the arrest. And so Dad mentions that there had to be some coordination between the Jewish leaders and the Romans. James? Yeah.
And so the fact that he was alone in the Garden of Gethsemane, that means that Judas was one of the few people that would have known where he was.
Yeah, James is pointing out that the fact that there weren't crowds there at Jesus, at the Garden, at the Mount of Olives, would indicate that the people didn't know. This would have been a good place. Judas knew, and we'll see that in the text. What did Judas expect to happen to Jesus when the leaders arrested him? What was Judas' expectations of what would happen after the arrest of Jesus? Does the Bible say?
I don't think he even had any expectations. He was all about the money for him. And he was going to just cash out and check out.
Surely he had to think something would happen. I mean, he may have been focused on the money, but surely he had to had some expectation. Is Jesus going to get run out of town? Or is Jesus going to get scourged and released? Or is Jesus going to be killed? It doesn't really say. But you have to think about that because Judas had spent years with Jesus. To get to the point to want to end that relationship, whatever happened to Jesus, that's a big moment. That's a big decision for him. And how much, Glenn?
Well, none of the other 11 expected he was going to die.
Right.
So
yeah.
Whatever Judas is
okay, it's possible he didn't expect the death. How much money at the time was 30 pieces of silver? I mean, that was the price. Is Judas now going to be set, and so he doesn't care about what happens moving forward? 30 pieces of silver is just so much, he can just sit back and he's set for life now? No? It wasn't much. What's that? Yeah, you know, it's money. It's significant money, but it's not enough, seemingly, to change your whole life's course projection on. 30 pieces of silver, then there's arguments about precisely what that is today, but probably it's around $10,000 to $15,000 in today's money. So it's money, but it's not a year's worth of wages like the alabaster ointment that was applied to Jesus' feet that he complained about. It's not even that much money. It's money, but it's not a lot of money. So it's all interesting trying to figure out the mindset of the apostles in these moments, and Judas especially. So, okay. I'm getting distracted already. The slide in front of us is to recap the last week. And, of course, it starts on Sunday with the triumphant entry, and we've looked at that in detail. And then, of course, Friday is the crucifixion. The resurrection occurs just a couple days later. Friday, Saturday, Sunday is the resurrection. And we've been looking in the past month at some of these different actions earlier in the week. The cleansing of the temple, the religious leaders' challenges to Jesus, and then this upper room discourse we've been discussing in the last couple weeks. All right, that's where we are in the setting of the text. One thing to keep in mind, when did the Jewish day begin?
Sunset
is when a new day began, which is hard for us to really think about because when we wake up in the morning, it's a new day. And we even have that expression, well, it's a brand new day. When the Jews wake up in the morning, it's the same day. because the day starts at sundown. So the Friday we're going to be talking about happens at sundown, hour after the Last Supper, sometime perhaps the Last Supper extended past sundown. And then he goes right into the garden, the prayers, and then the arrest. And then the arrest, immediately the trials begin, and then immediately the crucifixion. So as soon as he's done with the Last Supper, as we call it, it's going to be nonstop action, and it's going to require his full attention mentally. His physical trials are beginning. It's nonstop as soon as he leaves that upper room until he's crucified. So you can imagine at the last meal the stress he's starting to feel. We see some of that when he prays in the garden, that stress. And that's all building because Friday night is the start of his last day before his crucifixion. It's all one day, and it just goes very quickly, one event to the next. Mark has in his book and on the slides a little bit of a picture of the setting. It doesn't show up as well on the slide as it does in the book, but you can see here a painting from Mount Olive looking back towards Jerusalem. Very picturesque. You can see the valley between the mountain and the city. This is where Jesus was at the time of his arrest. Zooms in a little bit here, back towards the city and towards that valley that separates the Mount of Olives from the city that they all had to cross over. Why was he there? Prayer, okay. Had he been here before? Yeah, it's already been mentioned. This is a place that he would come to. In Luke's account, Luke 21, if you go back to verse 37, a little bit before the events of this last day, we see that he went here often. His apostles knew he went here often. He goes at night, and he goes for the solitude. I mean, it's all very specific as to what he's doing here. In fact, during the feast, we talk about him going back and forth to Bethany, where he stays. But oftentimes, when he's in Jerusalem, he stays on the Mount of Olives. He spends the night outside here, because it's close to Jerusalem and it is secluded. His apostles know that. It's possible others knew as well. But in the passage in Luke 21:37, it talks about how he would be in the temple studying all day, and he would go only as far as the Mount of Olives, sleep on the mountain overnight, and then get right back in the temple in the morning. And the crowds would be there when he got to the temple, ready to listen, ready to ask questions. This is part of his routine. It wasn't unusual for him to go at night to the mountain. Oftentimes we see in the scriptures, in the account of his life, that he spent the entire night in prayer. And that was usually before some big event or big decision. He's going to God and he spends the whole night. This is going to be a big night, and the coming day is a big day. Why didn't he spend the whole night in prayer at this occasion? What prevented him from spending the whole night in prayer? Yeah, so he prays is up to the moment he can before the activity starts. Judas approaches with the mob. Is the exact moment he wraps up his prayer. So he would have, I'm sure, spent more time in prayer given the opportunity. But that's how rapid fire these events are going to happen. He only had a little bit of time from the Last Supper until the arrest. And so he's trying to commune with God in the opportunities he has. All right, Mark has provided some other maps here showing, again, the garden and the Mountain of Olives relative to the city. You can see they left that upper room and likely went straight across there was a bridge at times over the Kidron Valley, and other times there was not, and you just crossed it. It wasn't a river. It only held water in an unusual flood situation. It was usually a dry, 7-foot deep river bank, just a dry bed, to say. So at times there was bridges across there, at times there were not. He crosses over, ends in the garden, and one last figure. I'm sure Mark had a lot of important comments to make on this. You can see the temple in this one. The temple, you can see this is showing a bridge across the Kidron Valley, and then the Mount of Olives, and then you can even see two alternate locations for the crucifixion, one north of the city and one just a little bit west of the city. So that's all just setting for what's going to happen here. Interesting to note, in John's account, he specifies that Jesus crossed that Kidron Valley, and we'll look at this in a minute, as he's going into the garden. David, King David, when his son Absalom betrayed him and David had to flee the city, the big event, the moment when the nation realizes that David's betrayed, as he's crossing the Kidron Valley. And in 2 Samuel 15, we have that account when David's crossing the Kidron and his betrayal is been made public. And that watershed moment is there. And some suggest that that's the reason John mentions Jesus crossing the same valley at the moment of his betrayal, that there's a link there between King David and the heir of David, David's Lord, when he was betrayed. That treachery against the king, a moment being recorded. Okay. So all four accounts record these few moments of the betrayal and arrest. And we're going to start in Matthew 26. If you're not already there, you can go ahead and go, and we'll start in verse 47. But just to remind you of how we got to this exact moment, in Matthew 27, verse 45, Jesus had been praying upon the mountain, and he, of course, set aside his three closest apostles as near witnesses to what he was doing. He asked them to stand watch while he prayed. And what do you think he was anticipating they would be watching for? Yeah, probably the approaching mob. Now, how good of a job were they as watchmen? Yeah, they continually fall asleep. And so the third time, in this moment, recall, he's praying to God. He's in agony. He's coming to terms with how brutal this is going to be. And he comes back, and they're asleep for the third time. How upset would you be if you were Jesus in that moment and your three closest friends weren't in the same mental place as you? I'd be frustrated that they're not really getting this. Carter?
Probably stressed.
Stressed? Right. But then if you read in 45 what he says to them when he comes this third time, it's what strikes me is how patient he is with these three men in that moment. He says, and this is Matthew 26:45, then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Arise and let us go. Behold, the one who betrays me is at hand." That's a very calm reaction to this situation, I think. What we'll hopefully notice as we go through this is that Jesus is completely in control of the situation. Yes, he's being betrayed. Yes, he's going to be arrested. But he never loses control of the situation, even though as we move through it, he's got multiple goals he's trying to accomplish here. And some of these are kind of offsetting goals. They're contradictory. But his control in the instance is incredible. So I'm going to read. Okay. And how important was that prayer? Right. Right. Excellent point, Jolene says. If y'all didn't hear that, it was just a comment on the power then of prayer and how important that prayer was to help him through these moments. And then therefore, obviously, we have that same avenue of prayer available to us. Do we use it in the opportunities that we have and how much benefit it would be if we did? As we read these, and the accounts are short, I'm going to read all four accounts. And keep in mind as we go through a few things, the description of the company that comes, the order of the events as they unfold, anything unique about any one of the accounts. Judas, what's his position and what are his actions in this arrest? And finally, the words between Jesus and Judas. If you'll look at those things, I'm going to quickly read these four accounts and we can discuss. So as it says on the screen, Matthew 26:47 starting. And when he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a great multitude with swords and clubs from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now he who was betraying him gave them a sign, saying, whoever I shall kiss, he is the one, seize him. And immediately he went up to Jesus and said, Hail, Rabbi, and kissed him. And Jesus said to him, Friend, do what you have come for. Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus reached out and drew out his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. Then Jesus said to him, Put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? How then shall the scripture be fulfilled, that it must happen this way? At that time Jesus said to the multitude, Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me, as against a robber? Every day I used to sit in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But all this has taken place that the scriptures of the prophets may be fulfilled. Then all the disciples left him and fled. All right, and we'll proceed right into Mark chapter 14. I was going to have someone read this for me so I didn't have to talk this much, but I was standing in the back and not paying attention to the time and missed my opportunity. Mark, well, I want to do it from the, I was going to have someone come up and read from the microphone to people online to hear. I'll just read it since I got the microphone handy. Mark 14:43-52. And behold, while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a multitude with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Now he who was betraying him had given them a signal, saying, Whomever I shall kiss, he is the one, seize him, and lead him away under guard. And after coming, he immediately went to him, saying, Rabbi, and kissed him. And they laid hands on him and seized him. But a certain one of those who stood by drew their sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus answered and said to them, Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as against a robber? Every day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But this has happened that the scripture might be fulfilled. And they all left him and fled. Okay. Generally, was that pretty close to Matthew? That's very, very similar. They pick up on almost all the same actions. And most of the same text, although Matthew has a little bit more dialogue from Jesus. Luke 22:47. While he was still speaking, "Behold, a multitude came, and the one called Judas, one of the 12, was preceding them. And he approached Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, 'Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?' And when those who were around him saw what was going to happen, they said, 'Lord, shall we strike with the sword?' And a certain one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear. But Jesus answered and said, 'Stop, no more of this.' And he touched his ear and healed him. And Jesus said to the chief priests and officers of the temple and elders who had come out against him, 'Have you come out with swords and clubs as against a robber? While I was with you daily in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. But this hour and the power of darkness are yours.' And having arrested him, they led him away and brought him to the house of the high priest. And then lastly, John 18, starting in verse 2. Let's go ahead and read verse 1. John 18, 1 through 12. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the ravine of the Kidron, where there was a garden into which he himself entered, and his disciples. Now Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort, the officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, 'Whom do you seek?' They answered him, 'Jesus the Nazarene.' He said to them, 'I am he.' And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. When, therefore, he said to them, 'I am he,' they drew back and fell to the ground. Again, therefore, he asked them, 'Whom do you seek?' And they said, 'Jesus the Nazarene.' Jesus answered, 'I told you that I am he. If, therefore, you seek me, let these go their way, that the word might be fulfilled which he spoke, 'Of those whom thou hast given me, I lost not one.' Simon Peter, therefore, having a sword, drew it, and struck the high priest's slave, and cut off his right ear. The slave's name was Malchus. Jesus, therefore, said to Peter, 'Put the sword into its sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?' So the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him." Okay. So that is all four accounts. Any one of those less like the other? Does one stand out as a bit different? Yeah, the John account is got some different actions, some different dialogue. The big one, is at the beginning, and Mark had created a slide for this here, and pointing out this moment when he asked who they're seeking, and according to the passage, they say, "Jesus of Nazareth." He says, "I am he," and they drew back and fell to the ground. What's happening here? What's going on? Causes these men to fall down.
They were aware of Jesus' powers, the signs that he had performed.
Okay.
They were not, I don't think anybody was real thrilled about being in that group that
okay.
sent to do this.
Tell me a little bit about the group. Who was this multitude, this mob that came? According to these multiple verses, what do we get about the group?
There are priests, for sure. There are priests. There are soldiers.
The Roman soldiers cohort is mentioned. Officers of the priest. I don't know that the priests were there. They may have been, but certainly their servants were there. Would it be normal for a soldier to carry a club? That sound like something a soldier would do? What are the soldiers going to be carrying?
Swords.
Yeah. The Roman soldiers don't walk around with clubs. So the fact that there's men with swords and clubs tells me that, or it leads me to believe, that aside from the soldiers, there were Jewish servants, officers, who weren't allowed to carry swords, and they carried clubs. And when you see a crowd of people carrying clubs, what's the expectation? Yeah, they're probably going to use them. A soldier can keep his sword concealed in its sheath and go about his business. But if you're carrying a club as you walk around, the implication is you have expectation to use the club. So, and how big is a Roman cohort? I'm sure that's not a term we use today. I'm trying to get a sense for the size of the mob. The size of a cohort vary, but the smallest size is about 480 soldiers. So if you had around 500 Roman soldiers and some Jewish officers of the priest, you had a multitude. I would call that a multitude, you know, 500 plus people. It's a big crowd. They've got, obviously, the swords and the clubs are mentioned. Lanterns and torches are mentioned. So this is an intimidating group approaching, you know, in the night. I think they probably anticipated having to search for Jesus. They thought they knew, according to Judas, he would be on the mount somewhere. And perhaps all these torches are, they were expecting to have to beat the bushes to find him. And of course, Jesus goes to meet them to make that confrontation, just, you know, get this over with, okay? The fact that they fall down, it may have been just at the fear of the reputation of Jesus. But the Roman soldiers probably didn't have the same perspective as the Jewish members of this mob. It seems to me like something's happening here beyond their control. I don't know that they're stepping back in reverence or fear. It seems like, as he says, "I am he," and there's a lot of significance to that "I am" phrase in the Jewish language and how God used it to proclaim his deity. As he says this, it almost seems as God is just pushing these men back and demonstrating who's got the power in this situation. Is it the mob? It seems like God is just one last time, this is, it's totally under the control of God and Jesus. This situation isn't going to play out because of the strength of the swords and the clubs and the men. This is playing out because Jesus has a plan. It doesn't say what caused him to fall back, but that's the sense I get. I can't say that's what's happening here, but it seems to be one last demonstration that God is in control. And the men don't have the ability to arrest Jesus without his consent. Nikki? Right. But would these Jewish people have appreciated his use of that phrase? Okay.
Well, something like, "I'm the president."
Right.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to arrest you because you're the president. So.
We already know that the Jewish leaders are already upset with Jesus for using this kind of language already. And they've not been intimidated to relent. They just keep planning on getting this done, getting him out of the way. So I'm running out of time. John?
Normally when you have a crowd like that coming at you with clubs, you would expect the person that they're looking for to hide,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
Be afraid of them a little bit. You know, they are intimidating. But when he openly says, you know, "It's me."
Right.
"Here I am."
Yeah.
I imagine they were taken aback a little bit.
Yeah. So certainly Jesus is going to meet the situation. Okay. And I got way more material here than I expected. I'm going to be in trouble, run out of time. So let me keep moving. I really appreciate the thoughts. Huh? Yeah, I guess like Mark. The slide here points out the person who cut off the ear, it wasn't just some guy. It was Peter himself. And it's only identified in John that it was Peter. The other interesting thing is, you know, only Luke records that Jesus healed the ear. which is interesting. I mean, there's so many big things happening, and they're happening quickly. And the order of these events, when you read the accounts, it's not clear who said what first, what happened first. It's just one of these moments where the witnesses are seeing just so many things happening. They're recording different pieces that were impactful to them or important to their narrative. But the fact that it's Peter that cuts off the ear probably isn't surprising to us. What did Peter vow to do just earlier in the same day? When Jesus was talking about, I'm going to be killed, and Peter says, no, it's not going to happen. And Jesus says, you yourself will deny me. He says, if I had to die myself, you know, we're going to fight this. So it's really not surprising that Peter is the one who takes action. This is one of those things that in my mind's eye, I've always thought about this moment as someone taking a sword and cutting off an ear, and you have this, you know, very clean cut ear laying on the ground, and it's like, wow, you know, that's a really skillful blow that Peter struck. He cut the ear right off, and he picks it up, and Jesus puts it right back on, and, you know, everyone moves on. The more I think about how this would have played out, that's probably not the right image. I watch a show with Caleb called Forged in Fire. Did anybody watch that show? It's a competition show where current people, contestants, go on a show and they make knives or swords and they compete to who made the best knife, you know. And there's an expert panel of judges who also are historical weapons experts, and they know how to make a knife. And the three contestants make a knife, and they judge the knife based on its performance, right? Which is the strongest, which is the sharpest, which is the most durable, and all these crazy tests that these panel of experts will conduct the knives to see who's going to be the winner. And one of the things they do to test the knife is they'll use them against, like, a pig carcass. They'll hang a pig carcass from a hook, and they'll take a sword or a spear that someone's made, and they try to cut into it and see how well it does. Sometimes, instead of the pig, they make a ballistics gel human, like a dummy. And this gel solidifies. It's the same density as human flesh. And so if you hit the gel with a knife, you say, oh, it made 3-inch penetration into the gel, you would expect 3-inch penetration into a person. So, and it gets kind of gross because they put a real skeleton or a skeleton of similar material to a human skeleton into the gel, and they put fake organs into the gel and fake blood, and so you can test your sword and see how deadly it is. And one of the experts is not only an expert in the knives, but he's a weapons, martial arts expert in using these weapons. And so they'll set up these dummies, and they'll have this guy trying to do these certain, you know, kill slashes and stabs on these gels, these gel animals or gel humans. And what's interesting is, as an expert as he is, when he's swinging a weapon, he's not very precise. And he's trying to be precise. He's trying to, you know, I'm going to cut off this guy's head. But sometimes he'll hit him across the face, you know, and it's not at all what he was going for. And all these years of watching these episodes with Caleb about these guys cutting up these dummies, I've never once seen him accidentally cut off an ear. An ear is kind of a small thing. How is it that Peter was able to cut off an ear cleanly in this situation? I don't disagree with any of that, but I don't think Peter was skilled at all. I don't think he was lucky either. I think Peter was going for something else entirely and just happened to hit the side of the guy's head. And I don't think you could cut, with that sword that's shown there, I don't think you could cut off an ear cleanly if you were trying to. That's not the right weapon for a clean cut. So likely what happened, he's trying to cut off someone's head, and as bad as he is, he hits the side of the guy's head, and an ear comes off. But I'm pretty sure there was a lot of other damage in that moment. I don't think it was a clean cut. I don't think the guy was just standing there looking at his ear, wondering what happened. I think the guy probably had a concussion, probably a fractured skull. It was a bloody mess. And in my all these years, I've thought of it differently. So I think the miracle of Jesus healing that is way more impactful in that moment. And why didn't it impact those who saw that? It seems like only Luke records it, and the rest of the soldiers don't react. How is that?
Luke's the physician,
so it makes sense that he would cover that. He also said it was the right ear, and this is the guy's name. He was a physician and a historian. But in this moment, we've got a powder keg here. We've got people with weapons. We have Peter start flailing a sword. Jesus, his plan was to get arrested in this moment. But his plan was also to keep his apostles from getting injured, arrested, killed. Those are two very different things. Those don't go together. Jesus is walking a tightrope here. And Peter's unpredictable. And so the fact that Jesus is able to calm his disciples, in Luke, they ask, shall we strike with the sword? And Peter just starts slashing. He gets arrested. He keeps his apostles safe. And I think this miracle is a big part of that, demonstrating to his disciples, but also to the mob that was there, that we're not going to fight. I'm not going to fight. I'm going to just, please let these go, and I'll go with you. But I think this miracle was a big part in smoothing the tensions here. Okay. Again, that's my 2 cents worth. And Mark put in this familiar song we sing, 10,000 Angels, because Jesus does say in one of these accounts that, don't you think I could get 12 legions of angels if I wanted to? He's talking to his own followers. That's not what's going to happen here. And then he asked, and then we're going to go through the song. Obviously, we don't have time. We're familiar with the song. It's not strictly based on the words of Jesus, but it is the concepts he presents here. 10,000 angels is not what he called for. This goes back to Peter's mindset. I want to cover that, but we're going to be out of time. So Jesus demonstrates, I think, through this, that he was intent on following through with the plan. And also he's demonstrating that he was in control. And this is only occurring because Jesus is allowing it. Why did he ask them this? I was in the temple teaching daily. You never came to arrest me. Why was that? Why didn't they arrest him then, but they arrest him now? It was the crowds. He knows that. He's pointing out to them that he knows that. You're doing this in the cover of darkness. And he even calls them out as sons of the devil and those with the power of darkness. This is going to happen because it was part of the plan. I just think it's incredible how much control Jesus demonstrates in the situation and how chaotic this could have been. And yet he's keeping control. So, okay, we're out of time. Mark will be back. Is that right, John? Time is up? Okay. So Mark will be back next week, and he'll pick it up from there. Thanks for the comments.